Kat Brooks, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in Sacramento.
Yeah, so we were in Fun Drive last week, so we weren't able to really cover it. But last Monday, District Attorney Ann Schubert announced that there would be, in her words were, in the name of justice, there would be no criminal charges against the two police officers that killed Stephon Clark, who is, of course, the young man who just about a year ago was in his grandmother's backyard with a cell phone, and Sacramento police shot him over 20 times, igniting massive protests in the streets of Sacramento, rolling protests that went on for quite some time, a few that I participated in. And so last Monday's announcement was met with, again, protests. Over 80 protesters were arrested that night, including clergy and journalists. They were kettled on the bridge, given no way to get out, and arrested. Yesterday, it was announced that there'd be no charges pressed against those protesters, which makes sense. But since then, there have been rolling protests. So Monday night, there was the demonstrations in the streets. Then Tuesday, people took to city council. There have been student walkouts at both the high school, college level. There's a statewide action. And some organizers are using this to really push. And it's interesting. So last year, his murder was sort of the ignition for Dr. Shirley Weber's AB 931 use of force bill. And really sort of because it was in Sacramento and legislators were really feeling the heat of it, allowed that bill to progress as far as it did before dying. So it's sort of interesting now when Dr. Weber has reignited that bill, the California Act to Save Lives, AB 392. Again, his murder, and now, of course, there being no justice, I put that in air quotes, been given to the family or community, has community organizers and advocates using his death again to advocate for this use of force bill.
What would the bill do?
So the use of force bill simply says that law enforcement officers would have to use every single possible alternative, including de-escalation, before they shoot somebody. And so when I'm feeling particular...
That's not the law now.
No, that is not the law now. The law now is... that a cop can kill you if it's what another reasonable officer would do. That includes if you were fleeing. That includes if you were unarmed. That include right. They just can kill you. So this bill, when I'm feeling particularly pithy, I say it just would require them to do what they do when white men shoot people. You know, when they do what they did with the Waffle House shooter or the Parkland shooter, they would have to make sure it's a cell phone and not a gun before they gun somebody down. And this bill could create criminal liability if a police officer puts his or herself in the way or in the position of creating the situation where there's no way out.
How far did that bill get?
I don't remember.
It didn't get to the governor's desk.
No, it did not get to the governor's desk. It died in appropriations, I believe.
Because they'd have to pay money to overhaul officer standards and training?
They really would not. And actually, part of what the problem with the last bill cycle was is that it came with a $25 million budget give to POST, which is the police officers' training, whether the bill passed or not. Mm-hmm. So we did these organizing efforts, and actually some coalition members fell off because of that. POST still ended up with $25 million. And so the good news for this round, though, is that they can't say that they don't have the money to retrain.
Wow.
And the new governor, Newsom, do you see any difference between him, or have you heard anything from him that would differentiate him from, say, Jerry Brown?
I mean, people are more hopeful around him with police accountability. I have not heard or seen anything that makes me any more hopeful. I mean, the one thing to say is that, you know, the biggest barrier that we have in the state of California to police transparency and accountability is the Peace Officers Bill of Rights. And Jerry Brown was actually responsible for getting that passed in the first place. So his stance with law enforcement was made clear before. Newsom doesn't have that record. It's also a different dynamic. Then, you know, the conversation around police accountability and transparency keeps pushing forward in pretty dramatic ways. And there's a lot of pressure, particularly right now. So we're hopeful. But I think this will be sort of Newsom's first big test around what he is or is not willing to do around police accountability. I mean,
if you can get it to his desk.
Right, if we can get it to his desk.
To the legislature first.
And we'll see. And the cops this time, the other thing that the cops did this time is that they've introduced their own bill, AB 230, which does nothing. But it would give legislators a way out and say, well, we passed this bill. And so that also gives Newsom a way out if they were to pass the cop bill.
It's also kind of a powerful signal of how far things have shifted, right? That they feel like some action has to be taken and better to get in front of it.
Well, yeah, right? They'd much rather their bill pass than our bill, mm-hmm. right? That actually limits them from being able to murder people.
I mean, it's interesting because 5-10 years ago, the statewide police lobby would have had every confidence that a bill like this wouldn't get out of its first committee, and they didn't have to blink twice or introduce their own legislation to derail it.
That's right. But yeah, things have changed. I mean, remember with AB 953, which was the racial profiling bill that we got passed, Jerry Brown said he would sign it over his dead body. It would take an act of God for him to sign that bill. But then when 300 clergy and community organizers occupied the state capitol outside of his office, all of a sudden, God seemed to be moving. So things have definitely shifted. There's community pressure in a way that there hasn't been before. And particularly families across the state are being organized and are self-organizing into a movement like we've never seen before. So it's definitely a new day in town. So we'll see. There's another protest, just really quickly. So tomorrow, 3 o'clock p.m., again, they will be occupying the Sacramento Police Department.
Mitch Jeserich, you wanted to speak about the fact that this week opens with Chelsea Manning back in prison.
Well, just the odyssey of Chelsea Manning mm-hmm. continues, right? Here is somebody who joined the military and then became known worldwide after leaking hundreds of thousands of top secret documents that really changed the world. I mean, it's important, I think, sometimes to remember what that meant back in 2010. Both we all know the videos that came out showing the Apache helicopters, the American Apache helicopters, shooting at journalists in Iraq, also shooting at a van that was gathering corpses out on the field. We know that it was because of these documents that Tunisia helped at least in part spark the revolution that occurred in Tunisia. And so now through this whole odyssey, then she gets jailed for 7 years or more time than anyone in history for leaking documents. And now she's back in jail because she is refusing to testify to a grand jury in Virginia over a case about those leaked documents in 2010. We don't know a lot about this case because it's still in the grand jury process, is which part of the reason that Chelsea Manning is protesting and refusing to testify at this trial, because Chelsea Manning, as she even said in her statement, it's all secret process. The prosecutor basically runs the show, and you don't have a defense attorney in there. I find it interesting that though she is back in jail over a case that she was originally, and again, she's in jail because she's refusing to testify. But this is a case that she was pardoned by the president, President Barack Obama, and I wonder. I search for any information, but couldn't find it.
Not pardoned, commuted.
Commuted, okay. But still, the fact that you would be then commuted from that, but means you can't be prosecuted for it again. But I just wonder if someone has ever had to go back to jail related to that case after either being pardoned or commuted by a president. Which is interesting. So the question that this all comes down to, I mean, this is a case that the Obama administration originally brought but then dropped the case, saying that this could infringe on press freedoms because we believe this is all geared towards Julian Assange and the publishing of those documents. So the Obama administration looked for every reason to try to find that Julian Assange had helped Chelsea Manning get those documents, and they eventually dropped that case. But now the Trump administration, and if you heard Democracy Now! In the previous hour, they played a clip from John Bolton, the national security advisor, saying in 2012 Chelsea Manning should be executed for treason. I mean, these are the people that are closest to Donald Trump right now. They've resuscitated this case and are now apparently looks like they want Chelsea Manning to testify as to whether or not, again, Julian Assange helped her obtain those documents by either breaking a password or any other way. And so that's what she's refusing to testify about. And she'll remain in jail until the judge said until either the grand jury is over or unless she decides to speak.
And that could be up to 18 months.
Yeah. It could be a while.
Typically, federal grand juries. Although that's not a hard deadline.
No, it's just the...
They could stay impaneled longer than that. But that would be from when they start. They're typically ended in 18 months. But it's not clear to me that it's the Trump administration, though, right? This is an investigation into WikiLeaks by federal prosecutors. WikiLeaks is alleged to have been covertly helping the Trump campaign defeat Hillary Clinton. Isn't it just as likely to be an investigation against the Trump administration as at the behest of the Trump administration?
I guess, again, we don't know, right? Because it's in a grand jury, so there's a lot we don't know. We just found out a few months ago that Julian Assange had even been indicted. Most of the reporting that I've seen around this points to the 2010 leak of the documents and not necessarily related to the 2016 election. So are they asking Chelsea Manning to come in to testify about 2010 because it's an auxiliary of what happened in 2016? It's possible. But you know, Chelsea Manning herself had nothing to do with what right. happened in 2016.
Kat Brooks, your council member.
She is my council member. We just wanted to take a moment and give our condolences to Councilmember Lynette Gibson McElhaney, District 3 of Oakland, whose son was gunned down over the weekend in Los Angeles. He's an Oakland native. He had just transferred from CSU East Bay and was studying music at USC and went out to go to the store and unfortunately ended up being killed. People might remember that in 2015, a young man named Torian, that the council member considered a grandson, was also lost to gun violence, and that has really been her rallying cry during her time in office. So our deepest condolences to the council member
That's
and her
terrible.
Family. It's awful.
Oh, I can't even imagine. Final announcement before I move on with the show. We wrapped up our fun drive on time Friday night, but short of our goal. As of this moment, exactly $24,941 short of our goal. So if by some chance you did not get a chance to pledge, we're still taking pledges online
at Pony up,
kpfa.org.
Mitch.
Yeah, that's right, Mitch. Kat and
what
I gave.
What was your pledge?
Kat and I gave on air.
We did. Did you give? What'd you give, Mitch, to keep the people stationed on the air?
I got the dinner with Kat Brooks.
$500. You all heard it. $500 pledge from Mitch Deserich on our show right now.
But he's got to find a date.
I could go online for that.
www.kpfa.org. We would greatly appreciate whatever you can do. That takes us to 7:32 in the morning. The program's up front. My name's Brian Edwards-Tiekert.
I'm Kat Brooks. And coming up next, Brian, Urban Shield. After many, many years, community had a victory that would dramatically recalibrate Urban Shield. The sheriff's office is pushing back. We are going to have Amber Akemi Piat, who is the director of health instead of punishment program at Human Impact Partners, in conversation with Sergeant Ray Kelly, a spokesman with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. That's next.
After the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. President Trump is reviving his border wall fight as he prepares to unveil a new budget today. Trump will seek $8.6 billion for the expanded border wall and impose steep spending cuts to other domestic programs. Economic advisor Larry Kudlow appeared on Fox, where host Chris Wallace asked about Trump's renewed attempt to win congressional support for his wall.
So there's going to be another budget fight over the wall?
Well, I suppose there will be. I would just say that the whole issue of the wall and border security is of paramount importance. We have a crisis down there. I think the president has made that case very effectively.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said in a statement that Congress refused to fund Trump's border wall and he was forced to admit defeat and reopen the government. The two warned the same thing will repeat itself if he tries this again. They said they hope Trump had learned his lesson. BART says it will take several days to determine what caused a massive network failure, which shut the entire system down for hours Saturday morning. BART says it's performing a comprehensive forensic evaluation to determine exactly what happened to cause the network failure. The computer network failed around 2:45 Saturday morning. Normal service was restored at 11. Thousands of people were affected, but the shutdown didn't cause the havoc that would have resulted if the failure had happened on a weekday during the morning commute. Aviation authorities in China, Indonesia, and Ethiopia have ordered airlines to ground their Boeing 737 MAX 8 planes after a Sunday crash in Ethiopia killed all 157 people on board. The crash of the Ethiopian Airlines jet shortly after takeoff from Addis Ababa is drawing renewed scrutiny of the plane just 4 months after a similar crash of the same model killed 189 people in Indonesia. Weather forecast for the San Francisco Bay Area: sunny and breezy, highs in the upper 50s, no rain forecast for this week. In Fresno and the central San Joaquin Valley, sunny, 61 to 66 degrees. I'm Eileen Alfandari. More news in 94.1 at 8 o'clock.
It is 7:34 in the morning. You're listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. After years of protests, the Stop Urban Shield Coalition, in partnership with community, won a victory last month with the Board of Supervisors that dramatically recalibrates Urban Shield and the ways the monies are spent. The Sheriff's Office, however, is fighting back and saying that the changes are not possible and will result in a loss of grant money from the federal government. Here joining me to discuss are Amber Akemi Piet, who is the Director of Health Instead of Punishment Program at Human Impact Partners and is a member of the Stop Urban Shield Coalition. Good morning, Amber.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
And on the phone joining this morning is Sergeant Ray Kelly, a spokesman with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. Good morning, Sergeant.
Good morning, Kat.
Thank you for joining us this morning. I've never had both parties on the phone when we've been reporting on Urban Shield, so I'm actually excited about this conversation. And so I never want to assume that listeners know what we're talking about. And so I actually want to have both of you define what Urban Shield is. Sergeant, I'll start with you.
Well, Urban Shield is a program, an exercise program that runs for about 3 days, usually around September of each year. It's tied to a larger program that we do called the Bay Area Urban Security Initiative Training and Exercise Program. It's a $5.5 million grant. It puts on a lot of classes for first responders, EMS, fire, and law enforcement and emergency managers. And then at the end of the year, we're supposed to put on a training exercise that kind of culminates in all of that learning. And so that's where Urban Shield was born out of about 12 years ago.
Amber, how would the Stop Urban Shield Coalition define Urban Shield?
Yeah, I mean, first I just want to put a friendly amendment on. We're talking about what Urban Shield was. Urban Shield was ended in March of 2018 by the Alameda County Board of Supervisors. So we're no longer talking about Urban Shield in the present tense. But what Urban Shield was a racist war games program and weapons expo that was started 12 years ago by the Alameda County Sheriff's Office. And, you know, one of the places where you can really see some of its Islamophobic roots is in the fact that it has been occurring on the weekend of 9/11. So,
Sergeant, what is the significance of it happening every year on the weekend of 9/11?
Well, you know, after 9/11 occurred, and many of us remember that time in our history, but in the first responder community, we saw that there were a lot of gaps and a lot of issues that were concerning. Some of those being that fire, law enforcement, and EMS were not communicating. They were not networking properly. They were not working as a united team to go and solve problems. And a lot of that had to do with interoperability, technology, and a lot of different other things that were never seen before that day. That day is a catastrophic day for this country, and it's a reminder, much like many other dates in history that are reminders for us to prepare. And like every year we prepare for earthquakes around the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. So there is significance to that day and what happened on that day and the first responder community. So I know that some of the opponents of Urban Shield characterize that as being Islamophobic or as setting a tone for Islamophobia, but that couldn't be further from the truth. But we understand those concerns that they have.
Amber, I see you shaking your head.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to hear Sergeant Kelly bring up some of the gaps in our emergency preparedness in the county and region. And, you know, all of us who were in Northern California this last November will believe me when I say that in 2018, last year was the deadliest and most destructive wildfire season on record in the state. And not only that, but we know, too, that the Bay Area is transected by a series of faults, including the San Andreas Fault, which make us particularly vulnerable to earthquakes. You know, earthquake scientists estimate that there's a 63% chance that we will experience a magnitude 6.7 or greater earthquake in the Bay Area in the next 18 years. So, you know, we know that climate disasters are terrible for everyone, but research really shows that they actually exacerbate existing societal inequities. And the fact of the matter is just, yes, that climate disasters will worsen inequality in our society. And we also know that climate disasters can create incredible windows for solidarity and community connectedness. You know, one example of that we saw was in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake. Or I think about the efforts of Mask Oakland, for example, to distribute thousands of masks to those who needed them most during the 2017 and 2018 fires. So that's really what this conversation actually has been about for the last year since the Board of Supervisors agreed to end Urban Shield as we know it. It's about how we can improve how we're able to show up for each other in our communities. Firefighters, emergency responders, and other professionals absolutely have a role and need training. No one is arguing that. But really, this is about thinking about how we can train our neighbors, our coworkers, our families, and others to really understand that disaster recovery works best when we work together.
Okay, so there were major shifts. So what happened was there was the vote for the board, and either of you can interrupt me if I'm wrong, was the vote by the Board of Supervisors to dramatically recalibrate the way Urban Shield functions. Then an ad hoc committee was formed. That ad hoc committee met for an extended period of time.
6 months.
6 months. And then put forth 63 recommendations.
Yes.
Of those 63 recommendations, how many were passed, accepted?
60.
60 out of 63. And so some of those...
Yeah,
go ahead, Sergeant.
We went to the board, and the sheriff agreed to probably well over two dozen of those right off the bat. And then what the board did was they asked us to go back, meet and confer with the ad hoc committee, and come up with further ways that we could achieve more of those 63 recommendations. We were able to do that last week in an eight-hour session with the ad hoc committee and the sheriff's office and come to some consensus. So you're right when you talk about Urban Shield is changing, that we're reconstituting it. And one of the things we've talked about and one of the things that's been voiced is disaster preparedness. That's a big component. That's one thing we all agree on is the potential for fire and earthquakes. We spent a lot of time this last year responding to fires in Northern California. As we all know, just a devastating time for those communities and the fallout and effect that came all the way down here to the Bay Area. So we realize that citizen preparedness, citizen first responders play an important role. And so part of our shift is to be more inclusive of those citizen communities and be sensitive to some of our communities where their contact, their interactions with law enforcement have not always been the best. So the sheriff has been very sensitive to those issues. But we have to keep in mind that our Bay Area Yawassee region, there are 28 regions throughout the nation. We rank number 5 in our threat assessment. And we can't forget that we do live in an area that is prime for terrorist targets, active shooter situations, and emergencies that need to be handled by professionals. And so we're not saying that this is going to happen all the time, and we realize that a natural disaster is more likely than maybe some major attack. But that being said, the grant, specifically the guidelines of the grant, dictate that we have to train for those mass casualty man-made events while expanding our role into community preparedness.
Amber.
Yeah, I mean, I have two things I want to pick out from there, right? So, Sergeant Kelly, one of the things that you just said right now is that the sheriff agreed to accept a couple of dozens of recommendations. And I have some serious questions about why the sheriff thought he was even in a position to be accepting recommendations. This was a conversation between the Alameda County Board of Supervisors and the ad hoc committee. And for him to come in and sort of wiggle his way into the process, undermine the democratic process that the Alameda County Board of Supervisors set up was entirely inappropriate. And we saw the sheriff introduce some, try to throw some wrenches into the process to torpedo the entire thing at the very last minute,
like
with
what?
Some unfounded claims. Yes. So on February 22nd, the sheriff sent a memo to the Board of Supervisors claiming with completely unfounded that, you know, oh, I would love to accept all of the recommendations of the ad hoc committee. I would love to do so, but I just want to make sure that I'm in compliance with the grant, which we realize is disingenuous, right? We realize that, of course, the sheriff has some vested interests and biases that he is with which he is looking at the recommendations. And this piece about being concerned about being out of compliance with our grant is absurd. What the ad hoc committee's recommendations did was they actually brought us closer into compliance with the grant. And I can talk more about that as well. But these completely unfounded claims were just an attempt, a desperate attempt to sabotage the tremendous, tremendous amount of work that these ad hoc committee members put into this process that the Alameda County Board of Supervisors entrusted them to do.
In response to that, so there obviously the sheriff does have a role in this, in the fact that he's the one that administers the grant. And the way our county is set up is that the sheriff cannot receive grant funds unless he goes through the Board of Supervisors. But having managed this program for the last 12 years and being a stakeholder in the regional safety and security and preparedness of our region, because the sheriff is the Region 2 director for emergency services along the west coast of California from Monterey all the way up to the Oregon border. He has a significant role. So he is a stakeholder. So we would disagree with that. He is also an elected official within the county and has that constitutional right as an elected official. So, but that being said, the ad hoc committee did do a lot of work, but there were about 21 recommendations that were outside the grant guidelines, outside the memorandum of understanding, in conflict with the code of federal regulations. So what we did last week was we brought in the CEO of the Bay Area UWASI and had them, he and his staff, explain to the ad hoc committee why they were in violation in certain areas, and that we had to work around those issues. And that did occur. I think that people are missing the point there. That there were a lot of concessions made. So to say that the sheriff had no voice, no role in that doesn't make sense, because he is a major stakeholder in this program, in this grant, and he's the one ultimately has to administer it. And here's what people don't realize is that if we are in violation of any of those grant guidelines, the federal government can come back and hold us accountable, and the county would have to repay all those funds plus penalties and some other issues there. So we want to make sure you get it right, and that's what we expressed our concern. And that information was not what was called an 11th hour effort to kind of shoot down the ad hoc committee. It was not that. We didn't get the final ad hoc committee report until about a week before we were going to go to the board. And during that time, we had to go through those 63 recommendations, consult with attorneys, consult with the UWASI, and find where we were in conflict. So there wasn't a lot of time there for negotiating, for figuring things out. And we had brought a lot of these points to the ad hoc committee during that 6 months of meetings and said, hey, some of these things may be in violation of some of the recommendations. So the ad hoc committee has admitted that they understood that there were some conflicts. But, you know, we were able to have a very successful meeting last week. I think both parties would agree. So so I understand some of the things that are being said. But unless you were directly involved in this on both sides and did that deep dive for the last 6 months, there's a lot of misinformation that's out there.
It is 7:47 in the morning. You are listening to Upfront. We are talking Urban Shield with Amber Akimi-Piat, who's the director of the Health Instead of Punishment Program at Human Impact Partners, who is also a member of the Stop Urban Shield Coalition. We're also in conversation with Sergeant Ray Kelly, who is a spokesman with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. Amber, when Stop Urban Shield refers to the sheriff attempting to torpedo the process. You're talking about the letter that was sent to the Board of Supervisors the day of the vote, correct?
The Friday before the vote, yes.
Friday before the vote. And what did that letter say?
That letter had some very unfounded claims. And, you know, the sheriff and his allies on the Bay Area UASI have not identified any specific funding provisions that conflict with the ad hoc committee's recommendations. As I mentioned earlier, the ad hoc committee's recommendations will actually bring us into compliance with the MOU. So, for example, the sheriff has repeatedly failed to demonstrate, as required by grant guidelines, how the program will engage and or impact the whole community, including children, older adults, pregnant women, individuals with limited English proficiency, individuals with disabilities, and others with access and functional needs. The ad hoc committee recommendations actually include strategies for addressing this failure. And if Sheriff Ahern and Bay Area UASI were truly concerned about compliance with funding requirements, that concern would be reflected in all uses of UASI funds, not just the recommendations of the ad hoc committee that they don't like. And I know I'm hearing, you know, Sergeant Kelly say that some conflicting information about we didn't know what the recommendations were until a week before. We had no choice but to send that memo so close to it. And then I'm also hearing Sergeant Kelly say, but we brought some concerns to the ad hoc committee over the course of the full 6 months on the pieces that we had concerns about. So I'm not sure how those two things are apparently being held, but just to be clear and truthful about the timeline. The first ad hoc committee meeting was on September 21st, 2018. There were a few initial meetings, and the committee's recommendations were first introduced on November 19th. There were seven more public meetings, many of which I attended, that the sheriff's staff also attended over the next 2.5 months, and the recommendations were often printed for community members and staff to follow along as the committee deliberated how to best come to consensus on what they were pushing forward. So as early as November 19th, the sheriff could have voiced any concerns, and yet the sheriff did not send his memo until February 22nd, as I mentioned, the Friday before the board was set to vote on the finalized recommendations. He claimed he had no other choice, but I can really see only one reason to submit the letter at the 11th hour. It was a desperate attempt to obliterate the work that the ad hoc committee was entrusted to do by the Board of Supervisors.
So some of the things that came out is that there'd be no more utilization of the name Urban Shield, no more SWAT deployment scenarios, no more weapons expo, no more emergency preparedness exercises, and eliminating the competition aspect. And so, actually, I'm going to turn to you, Sergeant Kelly. Can you explain to me the difference between emergency preparedness and disaster preparedness?
Well, emergency preparedness for us in law enforcement and fire in the first responder world is having all of your equipment, all of your people, all of your personnel ready to go. It's too late to formulate a plan when there is an emergency, so you have to fall back on your training and your experience and your equipment to get it done. And so it's nice to be able to plan for emergencies, but as they rapidly unfold, and things are very chaotic, we have to fall back on our training, our experience, and our equipment. And that's a lot of what we do at Urban Shield. Disaster preparedness is a little bit different in the fact that we predict, we believe that certain things are going or are likely to occur. And so we prepare for those things. And that can be done all the way from individual community members preparing within their own homes, neighborhoods, and broader communities preparing, the experts in those fields working and assisting communities to be ready. You know, but we've done some amazing things through Urban Shield. You know, we've done points of distribution. We brought in nurses, doctors, other medical experts. We figured out ways to get to communities in a timely manner. And so there's been a lot of good things that have come out of Urban Shield. We know that some of our detractors, they focus in on militarization and a couple key words that are somewhat inflammatory because it's not true. But there's a lot of mischaracterizations out there, but there's a lot of good work being done at Urban Shield in preparing first responders and communities. And we've been, over the last 2 years, hosting what we call Gray Command, which is a community preparedness event, and that has grown and grown. So there's a lot of interest in that community preparedness event. And one of the things we're looking at, hopefully moving forward, is hosting that and maybe having, instead of a vendor show, which has been mischaracterized as well, but having maybe a community preparedness expo where all of this stuff together, community and first responder groups can go to this expo and then have different types of vendors there, community-based vendors, community-based organizations, and then law, fire, and EMS vendors as well. So trying to bring everybody in.
But Sergeant Kelly, then, you can understand, I'm sorry, you can understand, though, that when you have law enforcement and other professionals dressing up as if they were immigrants or Muslim, or, of course, there was the infamous year where Urban Shield exercise. Wait a minute. Let me finish, Sergeant. Did an exercise where they were standing off with Occupy protesters, how that could be concerning for people in the community. Yes?
Yeah, so absolutely. But so there were definitely some sensitivity issues early on in the Urban Shield program, in the early days of the Urban Shield program. But and there were times where as a society were moving and changing, and concerns became apparent around sensitivity issues, we fixed those. There's no doubt that there were situations that sent a wrong impression. Some things were in bad taste, and for those were regrettable. But we did, appoint a sensitivity monitor and to be more in compliance with what those community wishes are. But there absolutely were some mistakes made in regards to some of the role playing that was occurring, and that has been drastically changed.
Amber?
Here's the thing. We could debate all day long about whether or not a racist war games and weapons expo program should have ever been created. We could debate all day, did you all train with ICE in 2017 at Urban Shield despite the county being a welcoming county? I mean, yes, but we don't need to debate any of those things anymore. We don't need to rehash the past. Really, what we're doing here now is we're having a conversation about what's in our future, right? Urban Shield has ended. That conversation is over. That ship has sailed. What we're having a conversation about is who do we want to be as a county? What values do we want to represent? What community members are we here to protect and invest in? So we're interested in moving forward. The sheriff, there's a vote coming up on Tuesday. I hope we'll have time to talk about that a bit later. But, we are trying to move forward. And what the sheriff is doing right now is pulling out every tool in his toolbox to try to claw us back into the past. And really, we just need to march forward. We need to march forward with the ad hoc committee and the board of supervisors and just leave those debates for another day.
Sergeant Kelly, there has been growing and continuous community support for the ending of Urban Shield. Why would the Sheriff's Department not just say, you know what, hands up, okay, yeah, this is the will of the people?
Well, we would disagree because there has been a tremendous amount of support for Urban Shield in our community, and a lot of the voices that support Urban Shield are not necessarily as loud as some of the activist voices that are out there. But there's been a tremendous amount of support. If you talk to the Board of Supervisors, they've gotten a lot of letters and phone calls and emails in support of Urban Shield. And so, look, at the end of the day, we're willing to meet. We're willing to talk about it. Tuesday is a big day for the future of this program and reconstituting, redefining disaster and emergency preparedness in this county. We've heard all the voices. We've heard all the arguments. And so we'll have to see what happens on Tuesday moving forward. I don't think the sheriff is trying to be difficult. I think he's trying to make sure that the people that he's responsible for protecting, not just the people that work for him, but the citizens of this community, have something in place. Because if we don't have Urban Shield or something, some type of training program, then what would you like us to do? And so if not Urban Shield, then what? That is the question.
Amber?
Yeah, I mean, that is the question. And I just want to point out that, sorry, Kat's got a little bit of cough, that, this is not about ending training. You just suggested that this is about ending training. And frankly, we find that a bit offensive. You know, as I stated earlier, climate disasters exacerbate existing societal inequities. And our Stop Urban Shield Coalition is really led by the people who have been most harmed, most targeted by inequities and injustices. We are the particularly vulnerable communities leading this fight for our future. So what this does is not, it doesn't eliminate training. It expands training. It widens training. And who is going to be prepared to withstand disasters that we know we're going to face in the future?
What's happening on March 12th, Amber?
Yes. So this Tuesday, the Alameda County Board of Supervisors was supposed to hear a report back from the ad hoc committee. But again, because the sheriff apparently has no regard for respecting democratic processes or upholding promises or expectations, he's now put forward an agenda item to repeal the board's decision to approve the community-supported ad hoc committee recommendation. So yet again, another desperate attempt to claw back our community's victories. So we're asking folks to come out to that vote.
Sergeant Kelly, from your perspective, what's happening on Tuesday?
So from our perspective, we're going to go back to the board with the ad hoc committee. We're going to present the results of our meet and confer. I think you'll see some consensus there. I think you'll see some agreement there. And then we're hopeful that the board will approve the grant for the next year moving forward. The grant is 1 year at a time, so hopefully they'll approve it for the next year. And then we'll continue to move forward and grow reconstitute what Urban Shield is and what it means to our community. So to throw it out the window completely, I think would be a mistake. So we're hoping that compromise on both sides will be effective and that we can continue to move forward as a community, all agreeing that emergency and disaster preparedness is very important.
Amber, last words, 30 seconds.
Yep. So I just want to thank you again for having us on and facilitating this hopefully illuminating conversation. You know, despite the sheriff's tantrums and attempt to undermine our work, I'm feeling a lot of gratitude and hope. And I want to thank Supervisors Chan, Carson, Valle, and Miley for defending democracy, for listening to us, and for upholding science, the law, and our Bay Area values in support of the ad hoc committee's recommendations. And I hope you all feel like this is an exciting moment as well, and hope you all will join us tomorrow at 11 a.m. in the county chambers at 1221 Oak Street in Oakland as we support the supervisors in moving forward with the ad hoc committee's recommendations despite the sheriff's malicious attempts to drag us back into the past.
Okay, we have to leave it there. We have been joined by Amber Akimi-Pia, director of the Health Instead of Punishment program at Human Impact Partners, was also a member of the Stop Urban Shield Coalition. Thank you, Amber, for coming in.
Thank you.
And Sergeant Ray Kelly, who's a spokesman with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. Thanks for joining us, Sergeant.
Okay, thank you all. Thank you very much.